The assault ship swung into the sky lanes on either side of the block, and their arrays of 200 million lumen spot lamps turned the area into instant blinding daylight. The 967 sergeant behind him relayed his voice via the assault ship.
This is Coruscant National Security. Stay where you are. I repeat, stay where you are. Officers will be entering buildings. Please cooperate. Be ready to show your identity passes.
One or two doors had already opened, and some people stood on balconies and bathrobes, hands shielding their eyes against the ferocious white spot lamps. All along the walkways, there was a chaos of yelled commands and hammering on doors. There was no open area to assemble detainees to sort the Corellians from other passport holders who happened to be on the block. So commandos were going into buildings and assessing the occupants where they stood, or taking them outside to stand against walls while their homes were swept for what had now simply become loosely termed as threats. Jason and Ben ran along the main walkway, lightsabers drawn, looking for where they might be needed.
Galactic Guard, outside, now!
Ahead of them, a squad of four 967 troops confronted a set of locked doors. They leapt back from the doorway, flattening themselves at either side of the entrance. Jason went to their aid.
Ordnance, sir?
Said one of them. The voice was female. She held up the sensor readout, the nose, as they called it, attached to the back of her left gauntlet. It winked red and orange.
The nose sniffed something, and the occupants aren't cooperating. Stand clear. Three inside.
On the other side of the doorway, a commando with sergeant's insignia on his breastplate held a thermal imaging scanner against the wall.
If anything in there blows, sir, this isn't going to look pretty on HNE. You stand clear.
Sergeant, I won't ask anyone to do what I won't do myself, said Jason.
Show me the image.
The sergeant, Warut, turned the imager to face Jason. It had a pistol grip like a loudhailer. One end of the body a lens, and the other side a display that showed red on black. Three human shapes moving around in an area that was probably set one room back from the frontage, judging by the range shown on the display's grid.
Ben, do you sense anything?
Jason asked.
What does it feel like to you?
Ben's sense of danger was becoming very acute.
Dangerous, but not right now. Soon.
Explosives, but not assembled?
Is that what you feel?
Yes, said Jason. He motioned Warut back. Hold the gas trooper. You want them immobilized?
That's the general idea, sir, so they don't detonate anything.
Fine. Jason took a breath, visualized the interior of the ground floor and the door, and focused himself on the three people inside.
Sir?
Jason didn't hear the rest. He sent a force jolt through all three targets simultaneously, paralyzing them. And a second later, the doors blew open, not with the punishing shockwave of a conventional blast, but the contained violence of the Force.
Nice trick, sir,
Warut said, ready to ease through the torn gap that had been the front doors. Jason slipped in after him, followed by Ben and the rest of the squad. The three occupants of the house, a man in his 30s and two younger women, were crumpled on the floor of a back room, unconscious. Warut crouched down and checked them for a pulse.
Are they going to be okay?
It's harmless and temporary, said Jason. Just a shock to the spinal cord.
You're going to put us out of business, sir, said the female trooper. REBJ.
I wish that were true, but I suspect you're going to be busier than ever. Jason watched as one of the squad held out his left gauntlet, following some trace. He was searching for the explosives.
REBJ? Rapid entry by Jedi, sir. Very handy. You'll be in demand.
Fleet Surplus Disposal Lot, Galactic City, Coruscant.
Captain Solo, are you sure we can't accompany you back to Corellia?
C-3PO seemed reluctant to surrender the case of clothes to Han, as if hanging on to the handle would ensure that Han took him, too.
Yeah, nobody would ever notice a golden droid. You'd be invisible.
Han didn't like the smell of the small shuttle he'd bought from the government disposal lot. It was alien. He hadn't realized how much of that small detail of the Falcon was embedded in his sense of comfort.
Stay here. Besides, you and R2 can keep an eye on Jaina for us.
Han?
Leia's voice drifted from the small cargo bay.
Honey, nobody has protocol droids like him any longer. He'd be a...
Han, you need to see this. Han made his way back aft to see her staring transfixed at the holoscreen in one of the coffin-sized cabins.
Another bomb?
He asked. Try bomb shell. Han took a few moments to work out what he was looking at. Riot police. No, soldiers in black armor were storming buildings. And the caption said, Jobby Town, dawn raid on Corellian community. It was everything he expected from the Alliance. They were playing the Empire all over again, almost right down to the armor.
Oh, you reckon this is going to shock me?
Leia's mouth was slightly open. Her frown made her look as if she was close to tears. She held up her hand for quiet, and he saw it was shaking slightly. Jason, she said hoarsely. Han scanned the screen, expecting to see Jason injured or attacked, and then saw his son. His little boy, who had always had a soft heart, who could feel pain for others, directing soldiers into buildings to drag out Corellians. In that way of terrible and unimaginable things, it didn't look real. His mind conjured up a scenario instantly. It was a vile piece of fake propaganda. It was Thrakken's doing. It was a lie. But it wasn't. Leia put her hand to her mouth. Jason even had his lightsaber drawn. And he had Ben with him. Ben was taking part in the raid. Han couldn't speak.
Honey, what's happening to him?
Leia's voice was a whisper.
How could he do this?
All Han could think now was that they could be on the run from their own son, and that they'd be even less welcome back in Coronet if their identities were discovered.
3PO, Han called. 3PO, when the Falcon's ready, fly her over to us any way you can. Get back to the apartment now and call Jaina. Tell her we'll talk to her later. We have to go. Got it?
I have indeed got it, Captain Solo.
Galactic Alliance Guard HQ, Quadrant A-89, Galactic City, 0830 hours.
Jason came out of the GAG briefing room to find Mara standing with her hands on her hips, as if he'd kept her waiting a little too long. She looked more under control than relaxed. Her expression was carefully neutral, but he could feel the fear in her and see the dark circles under her eyes. She stared.
When did you start wearing a uniform?
Jason glanced down at his black fatigues, hands held away from his sides. I should have changed before we carried out the raids. Jedi robes and police actions don't mix.
You're telling me. Luke's going crazy. Emergency meeting of the High Council right now, in fact.
I meant all that loose fabric is... Never mind. Mara indicated her own battle jacket.
Sorry, Jason, it's just a shock to see you in that uniform. I'm a colonel now. I'm not arguing, I just wanted to talk to you before Luke finds you. Is Ben okay?
He did very well. You want to see him? He's in the briefing room. We're just doing a wash-up with the squad leaders to work out what we'll do differently next time. And watching the news on the hour, of course. Mara managed not to raise an eyebrow.
There's going to be a next time, then.
You turned the job down. What did you think?
That it was going to be dirty.
It is. But churning through war after war because we don't ever fully deal with unrest is a lot dirtier. The briefing room door slid open, and a corporal from 967 Commando, LeCauf, stuck his head out.
Sir, you're on again, he said with a grin. Sorry, ma'am. H&E news.
Don't let me interrupt you, said Mara. Just passing.
Jason took her arm.
Come in and meet my men.
She recoiled visibly at the sight of Ben in black fatigues. He was sitting at the table with Shivu and the sergeants, cup of caff in one hand and datapad in the other. And even his body language was suddenly becoming adult. He was mirroring the adult males around him without even realizing. When he stood up to greet Mara, it struck Jason that Ben would soon be as tall as he was.
Ma'am,
said Ben, all grave concentration. Not mom, ma'am.
I didn't sense you coming. I just dropped by to say that I watched the Holo news and I wanted to see how you were feeling, said Mara. Are you all right? Son.
Apart from getting up at 0200, I'm fine.
You're getting so military, Mara managed to grin. You're sure you're okay? Why wouldn't I be? It wasn't dangerous, like the assault on Centerpoint. Captain Shiva was watching my six.
Jason found it touching that Ben had formed a bond with the 967. It boded well.
Here we go,
said LeCauf, and turned up the audio on the briefing room's holoscreen. The image flashed up the tagline cracked down at the bottom of the screen, and H&E anchors went into a recap of the morning's raid on Jobby Town. 4 hours after the raids, the news emphasis had turned from the drama of hovering assault ships and commandos breaching doors to public reaction. Admiral Nyathol contributed a 30-second defense of the GAG's actions. 967 Commando was, after all, now part of her special operations forces, but it didn't appear that defense was necessary. Jason, braced for opprobrium, was taken aback by the reactions of Coruscanti asked for their opinion on the streets and walkways of Galactic City.
It's about time, said one man in a business suit. I think Colonel Solo did what we should have done a long time ago. We're too scared of upsetting other governments. Well, Corellia. Not anymore.
Mara murmured, faintly sarcastic.
Ooh, you've got fans. Didn't plan that.
I know. I hope Luke sees it that way too, said Jason, knowing that he wouldn't. And Admiral Nyathol.
I'll try convincing him.
Jason still felt a flutter of hesitation around her.
I know you're still troubled by all this. Okay, let me ask you a question.
Go ahead. Mara's eyes were fixed on his now.
Is there someone in your life who's causing you some pain?
I don't understand. You really didn't.
A woman, Jason. I'm not prying. I just need to know if you're having a difficult time.
He thought of Tanel Ka and Alana. He hardly dared do that these days, in case Lumaya sensed his secret and they were put in danger. More danger than they already were in.
Yes, it was so true that it hurt. There's someone I would like to be with that I can't.
Mara exuded pure relief. The frown lines between her eyebrows vanished and she almost smiled.
That's all I needed to know, Jason. I'm sorry you're having problems. I won't mention it again. But if I can do anything, you let me know, okay?
Jason nodded. He couldn't imagine anything that Mara could do, but it was comforting to know she was willing.
Thanks, Mara, he said.
You're probably about my only friend these days.
Durgedjan's house, Coronet Corellia.
That Gedjan kid didn't seem quite so pleased to see Han this time.
You gonna invite us in?
Han filled his doorway, blaster held at his side, and Gedjan stared at it wide-eyed.
We're feeling kind of unwelcome out here.
Gedjan stood back, eyes still on the blaster, as Han and Leia slipped into his hallway. Han flicked on the safety.
Where have you been?
Asked Gedjan.
We ran into a well-wisher and had to make a run for it, said Leia. And before you ask, yes, we know what's happening on Coruscant. Sal Solo is having a field day with it.
Two small children emerged behind Gedjan, and he shooed them back into the room.
The Solo Sun imprisoning innocent Corellians? Inspiring headlines.
Han snorted.
I'm glad I don't shock easy. Does this mean he's changed the contract on me to read extra dead?
Us, Leia muttered.
Gedjan ushered them into his front room, and Han noted that the blinds were drawn.
Where are you staying?
Han didn't sit down despite the mute offer of a chair.
That's our little secret.
Okay.
Gedjan didn't appear offended. Paranoia seemed a normal part of political life.
My sources say there's more than one taker for the contract.
Fett doesn't play well with others.
Told you it wasn't Fett, said Leia.
Fett or no Fett, Captain Solo, the threat is real. And while we're appalled at what your son appears to be doing, Thrakken Sal Solo is pursuing his line for his own ends, not Corellia's. So as far as we're concerned, we still have common cause.
Who's we?
The Democratic Alliance. We understand how hard it is for you.
You think?
You're here, aren't you? We know you put Corellia first.
I'm going to deal with Thrakken myself, thanks.
We can't be seen to do that, of course, but we can probably give you useful support.
Just keep feeding me information about Thrakken's location, said Han. Your party representatives have access to that, right?
When he's taking part in government business, yes. Itineraries, meetings, that kind of detail.
Good.
So, what's your plan?
Han gave him a slow, wary smile.
If I told you that, you wouldn't be able to deny involvement, would you?
Gedgen went to a desk in the corner of the room and took a data chip from a drawer.
Floor plans, he said. Government buildings, they're not illegal, just only available for inspection in libraries and civic offices. They might be useful.
Consider me a librarian.
Dur, said Leia, if Thrakken Sal Solo were to fall from power, would your party be in a position to form an emergency government?
Gedgen was now focused totally on Leia. That was what really interested him, the seizure of power. Han chose not to be offended.
With my colleagues, the Corellian Liberal Front, and those in the Centerpoint Party who'd like a change of leadership, yes.
So that's how a coup happens, Han thought. In some guy's living room, while his kids are playing in another room.
Senate Chamber, Coruscant. Emergency debate on internment policy.
Jason sat next to Nyathol on the Mon Calamari delegate's platform and listened to Corellia's Senator Char haranguing Chief Omis about the abuse of human rights on Coruscant and the lack of consultation with the Senate.
We have no option but to withdraw our ambassador, said Char.
Is that Coruscant or the Alliance we're talking about?
Omis asked. Char hesitated.
Isn't that one and the same, Chief of State?
I think the Honorable Representative from Corellia understands that the action I took was to ensure the safety of Coruscant citizens, which is a responsibility given to me by the Coruscanti local authority, and so does not require sanction by the Senate. So which entity do you wish to withdraw representation from?
There was a general murmur of support, but significant barracking from some of the Outer Rim delegates. Omis stood his ground.
How do you feel about that blockade, Admiral? Jason asked quietly.
Are you asking if I could mount one now?
I'm assuming you can. Do you still favor one?
Yes, because that's the most robust stance I can persuade the Senate to allow. And blockades are very flexible responses,
Nyathol said. If it were carried out on behalf of the Alliance, that is.
We live in a world of blurred lines.
After the debate, Jason and Nyathol joined Omis in the Chief of State's cabinet room, where Senator Gasil was already waiting. Omis didn't look happy, and sat down at the head of the lapis-inlaid table with slow deliberation.
I'm getting very uneasy about this, Admiral, said Omis. The images on the HNE might have played well to the jingoistic element on Coruscant, but it reminded a lot of us of Imperial excesses. You authorized the action.
Nyathol fixed Omis with that head-tilted stare.
What did you expect it to remind you of?
Jason cut in. We're simply doing the same as terrorists, except we caused no serious casualties. A small action, creating a disproportionately large impact. This is as much a propaganda war as anything.
You plan to scare Corellians out?
Omis said. Nyathol lowered her voice.
No. We plan to make it clear we will deal with threats to the population of Coruscant. And that's why you go in and do your own sleight of hand, is it?
Omis was addressing his remarks to Nyathol, even though it had been Jason's operation.
One massive overreaction makes it look as if you have the whole situation under control.
If that's how you want to see it, Chief Omis, yes, Jason answered. No deaths, a reassured public, a clear statement to any who want to kill and maim civilians that they won't be tolerated. Removing truly dangerous individuals from our streets. And also sending a message that if Corellia can be stopped from pursuing a destructive path at the expense of the common good, then any world can. Or would you rather let the enemies within erode our society? These are people who are happy to accept the benefits of being a Coruscant resident, an Alliance citizen, but don't want the effort of being loyal to it. If that's my sleight of hand, then I'll sleep soundly tonight. Omis looked about to speak, but simply glanced down at his hands as if making a conscious effort not to respond. He was too wily a politician to take on both Jason and Nyathol in front of Gasil.
If he lost, Gasil would smell blood.
If you'll excuse me, I have to talk to the Corellian Embassy.
Omis stood up and walked to the doors.
I'd appreciate a schedule of your next operations in advance.
Arcanian Microtechnologies Headquarters, Vohai.
If there was a weak point in any perimeter, Boba Fett would find it. And he had. He watched a small bird, a hummer, bright scarlet, perch on top of the 4-meter-high perimeter fence that ran for 6 kilometers around Arcanian Micro's headquarters, and noted that there was no reaction from the guards in the gatehouse. There was no point having a security system so sensitive that birds could set it off, and if a bird could get over that fence, then so could Fett. Fett adjusted the controls of his jetpack and soared over the fence. He sprinted to the cover of the wall and jetted to the flat roof. Normally, he would have fired his grappling hook and climbed, but speed mattered now. It was worth the extra jetpack fuel. He lay on his belly and crept across the roof, his visor almost touching the gravelly surface as the penetrating radar scanned for people within. It was a huge area to cover. He pressed a medical sound sensor, more sensitive than the military ones, to the roof to pick up what signal he could. From the sound of the conversation immediately below him, a woman recording someone's educational details, he landed over the personnel department, and he was still crawling across offices that had external windows. Tanhui would be somewhere far from daylight, right at the center. It took him more than 2 hours to edge his way across what seemed to him a featureless charcoal-gray cinder plain, listening for clues to what lay beneath, and watching the radar outlines of bodies moving. Fett heard the clink of glass dishes and the whoosh and oomph of chiller cabinets opening and closing. He saw people sitting, probably at a long bench, and others clustered around a table. The outlines of the inorganic objects were almost impossible to make out, but he was used to assembling a mental image from the scant cues provided by the movement and shape of bodies. He'd seen a few labs in his time. He knew how Tanhui liked hers laid out. When she'd had a leg clone for him a few years before, her Tapaka laboratory had still been just like it was when he was a kid, and she had first shown him around. He heard the occasional word that sounded like a conversation about a scanning microscope. Could mean anything. He checked the chrono readout in his helmet, shifting his focus and feeling the beginning of a headache. 3 hours. Too slow. And then he heard it. Just a couple of words. It was Tanhui's fluting, gentle voice. He forgot the raw ache in his sternum and felt the adrenaline course through his body, erasing every pain. Gotcha. He frame-grabbed the coordinates in his HUD, got to his knees, and scouted around for an air vent. There was a biohazard containment opening 50 meters across the roof, and he knew it would yield to the lock overrides on his wristband. He hadn't met a lock seal or panel that didn't. He slid down the vent and found himself standing in a chamber with 2 doors leading off it. Both were locked. He adjusted his helmet sound sensors and listened. The corridor outside was clear. A quick flick back to the terahertz radar scan confirmed it. He made his way down the corridor, checking as he went, following the occasional sound of Tanhui's voice, until he found himself outside an office with 2 shapes visible inside on his helmet scanner. One dense human body, and a Kaminoan one, with its characteristic abdominal spaces. Fett ducked into the nearest alcove, a fire control station, and waited for the human to leave. Eventually, the doors opened, and a woman left. The lock panel at the side of the doors flashed again, but Fett slid a blade from his override system into the slot, and the doors parted with a whisper. He took the precaution of locking them behind him. Leaning over the desk, a tall creature with a long, graceful neck and small, round gray head, was engrossed in work at a data screen. Tanhui didn't turn around.
Please leave the file in the tray.
Nice place you got here.
Kaminoans never showed emotion, but the speed with which Tanhui whipped around and the way her head jerked back on seeing him told him she was surprised.
Boba.
Oddly, there's only one.
How did you find me?
It's my job, remember?
Fett lifted his helmet.
Let's say I followed the money.
Koenei sent you to...
No. He wants data back. That's not why I'm here.
Tan Hui stared into his face, blinking slowly.
Are you all right, Boba? Is your leg functioning properly?
No. In fact, my whole body is giving me a few problems.
Can I be of help?
I'm suffering from tissue degeneration. Liver problems, autoimmune diseases, tumors. My doctor says I have a year or so to live if I'm lucky.
He reached in his belt for a data chip.
Take a look at the tests.
Tan Hui took the chip with long, thin fingers and slid it into her data port.
Ah, I see.
She got up and went to a cabinet, and Fett's natural mistrust of the galaxy kicked in. If she could run out on her own government, she could betray him. He clicked his blaster just as a warning.
Boba, I regret that I don't have the skills to help you.
I guessed as much, said Fett. I just want your data and some information.
My data belongs to Arcanian Micro.
The data belongs to the Kaminoan government. But seeing as they aren't paying me, I'll take it to cover my expenses.
I can't hand it over.
So I'll take it.
Fett slipped the data breaker from a pouch on his belt and flipped it over in his left hand. He selected the docking interface that fit Arcanian Micro's computer system. The device had a dozen different plugs that rotated into position on a wheel.
Or copy it anyway. I don't plan to sell it. Yet.
Tan Hui blinked slowly.
It will ruin Arcanian Micro.
Tough.
And it will ruin me. Do you feel no compassion for me, Boba?
No. I don't believe I do. Not now.
Still holding his blaster on the scientist, Fett took 3 paces to the computer console and slid the data breaker into the port. The device sparkled with blue and green status lights to show that it was searching and downloading, and he let it gather a lot more data than he needed. He wasn't a thief, but other Arcanian microdata might come in handy, and even save his life. He was just taking custody of a copy of it.
I don't make deals, he said.
The status bar indicated that 5,000 exabytes of data had been swallowed whole. Complete genomes took a lot of memory.
But here's a promise. Tell me all you know about Kosai, and I won't hand this data over to the highest bidder. Then I'll make sure you're still of use to Arcanian Micro.
She's dead.
I still want to know everything.
Tan Hui paused for a moment, blinking slowly at the blaster.
Are you going to take me back to Kamino by force?
No, I don't need the credits.
But would you kill me, Boba?
He paused.
Yes.
She still seemed puzzled, not hurt or afraid or betrayed.
Very well. Kosai thought the cloning program would be destroyed, so she defected to the Separatists during the Battle of Kamino to save her life's work.
And her own skin.
We are not materialistic, Boba. It was not about payment. It was about pride. About excellence.
Fett slipped the data breaker back into his belt.
Get on with it. Where did she go?
I have no idea where her journey took her next.
What happened to her?
She was traced.
By who?
Another pause. Whatever it was giving Tan Hui problems.
Clone intelligence units. And one of your father's commando instructors.
Fett swallowed hard.
And?
She indicated the braided Wookiee pelt strung from his right shoulder plate.
She fell prey to the Mandalorian penchant for souvenirs.
Interesting, said Fett. So the clones got their revenge.
We assumed so. Packages arrived, parts of a Kaminoan body, whose genetic profile was Kosai's.
Fett found that unnecessarily brutal.
And a data.
We can only assume that they took that too. It has never been recovered.
What was special about it?
Kosai's triumph was controlling the aging process. She knew how to manipulate it better than any other biologist. We were interested only in accelerating it to mature clones faster, but I can see how many would find slowing the process and its therapeutic potential an attractive commodity. She claimed she was able to achieve it in the laboratory.
You got any names?
Tanwi stiffened.
Do you remember that aggressive little human called Skirata? The one who threatened my colleagues with a knife so frequently?
Yes, he remembered Cal Skirata all right. Sometimes his father swore he was the best of the bunch. Sometimes he just swore at him and lashed out. Jango Fett rarely lost his temper, but Skirata had a talent for making that happen. He was ferociously and uncompromisingly Mandalorian. As a lonely kid on Kamino, Fett had narrowly escaped being forced to learn Mandoa from Skirata's wildly unpredictable Special Forces trainees, six cloned ARC troopers who answered only to him. They were intelligence units, the Nulls, as everyone called them, the first batch of clones, and they had turned out crazy, hyper-smart, and dangerous. They had disappeared when the war ended.
"Useful," said Fett. "You keep quiet about this, and I'll keep this data to myself. Got it?"
"Agreed. And if, when you find Kosai's data, we would give you an excellent fee for its return..."
"Maybe I don't want to sell it."
"What do you plan to do with your legacy?"
"What?"
"You're dying. And even if you succeed in finding Kosai's data, and it can help you, then you still face the question of what legacy you will leave behind."
"Why does that worry you?"
"I believe it was a concern to your father. He told Count Dooku that he did not want a son. He wanted an apprentice to be Jaster's legacy."
That stung. Maybe Tanwi didn't mean it the way it sounded. He remained deadpan and wished he had kept his helmet on.
"Jaster Maria was more than Dad's mentor. He was a father."
"And what is that legacy?"
"To be a Mandalore. To make sure Mandalorians survive, whatever happens. And I'll live up to my father's pledge just as he did before me."
Tanwi remained glacial.
"We will exceed any offer."
"I'll let you know."
He put on his helmet and turned to leave.
"I would like to know if you find Kosai's research, and if it cures you."
Fett resisted the urge to ask if that was personal or professional concern.
"If I'm still around in a couple of years, you will."
He left the way he had come in, crawling back up the hazmat access hatch with the aid of his grappling hook, and covering the distance to the edge of the roof in a rapid crawl. Checking around him, he jetted over the fence. Slave One's ramp lowered via his remote helmet link, and he stepped up it, wondering why he clung so fiercely to his father's ship. It was a wonderful vessel, but it meant more to him than just the best his fortune could buy.
"So you didn't trust the cockpit?"
he said, opening the conversation for once. Myrta was wiping the console. It looked remarkably shiny. Fett kept a clean, well-maintained ship, but this time it looked polished.
"Did you get what you came for?" she asked.
He kicked Slave One into life and lifted her clear, looping under the monorail that snaked 2 kilometers above Vohai's surface.
"I did."
"So where are we heading?"
"You've got the necklace. You tell me where we're heading."
Myrta took the leather cord from her neck and stared at the shimmering stone in her palm.
"Let's try Coruscant."
Fett laid in a course for the Galactic Core, 000. Slave One was about to make the jump to hyperspace when the comlink console flashed impatiently in front of him. Fett switched the call to a secure circuit.
"Fett here, make it fast."
There was a slight pause.
"And this is Thrakken Sal Solo, Corellian head of state. I've got a proposal for you."
Squadron Training Sector to Airspace, Sentax 2.
The XJ-7 below Luke jinked to port and fell away beneath him with astonishing speed, even for him. Jaina Solo was a serious challenge in aerial combat.
"Or maybe I'm slowing down."
Luke throttled his own XJ-7 into a dive, plummeting into the moon's canyons in pursuit of Jaina. He thought she'd had enough flight time recently not to need to sharpen her skills, but when Jaina said she was returning to active service, she meant it. She went on exercises with the squadron, just like the new intake, colonel or not. It was a live fire exercise, too. Some of the pilots had never been shot at for real. It tended to change their perspective of warfare. Beneath them, on the valley floor, a droid anti-aircraft battery let loose with ion cannons. The red bolts of energy soaring up at him seemed to merge into a single field, with the red halos of the XJ-7's engines as Jaina zipped between the bolts, rolling instantly through 180 degrees to narrow the fighter's profile and sending a stream of fire into the ion cannons. She leveled out at the bottom of the canyon behind the battery, and Luke dropped down behind her, shaving the canyon floor so closely that the downdraft from the XJ-7 threw up a cloud of tiny pebbles that hammered under the fuselage. Luke sent a volley of fire after her, aiming a few degrees wide of her starboard wings. The canyon wall spat plumes of pulverized rock in her path, and she skimmed over it. She broke calm silence, which wasn't like her.
"Don't play, Uncle. It won't help me."
"I'm breaking," he said, and climbed sharply to level out on a cruising altitude. "See you back at the mess." Sentax 2 was a sterile moon with the usual sprawl of military facilities, arranged like a warehouse floor covered in boxes. Luke lifted the canopy of the XJ-7 and climbed out of the cockpit to slide down the ladder, wheeled into position by ground crew. He waited at the entrance to the mess until Jaina's fighter swept into the hangar on repulsor power and settled in the bay next to his. When she slid out and took off her helmet, her face was taut and anxious.
"You're up to speed," Luke said comfortingly, walking toward the doors to get her to follow him. "Are we allowed to wear flight suits in the mess?"
Jaina managed to smile and indicated her own orange suit.
"Don't worry, I'm the colonel. I'll provide top cover."
The mess was a warren of compartments, with one large section where food was served and eaten, and a lounge area almost the same size that was scattered with comfortable seating and sparse entertainment, the main focus of which was a huge holoscreen on one wall. It was wide enough to be seen comfortably from the refectory area while pilots and ground personnel waited for meals to be dispensed. Most of the pilots in the lounge area had their backs to the refectory and were watching the screen. The lunchtime HNE news had started, and that now meant complete silence descended. Everyone was waiting and watching for the little twitches from the politicians that would mean that the squadron's warned status would switch immediately to mobilized. Jaina reached over the counter to scoop some vegetables onto her plate, just as the top headline boomed to fill the entire complex. It didn't, of course, but Luke felt that it did. He froze.
"And today's top story, the roundup of Corellian nationals continues as thousands leave Galactic City in a voluntary repatriation program."
The screen was filled with a shot of 967 Commando shock troopers advancing down the walkways at either side of a Coruscant residential skylane. One squad preceded by the now familiar figure of Jason Solo in a stark black coverall of the kind favored by special forces. That would have been bad enough, but the only other person in any kind of uniform with his face visible was Ben. It was very, very quiet in the mess now.
"My son, how did I ever let Jason do this to him?"
The shock troopers all wore fully enclosed helmets. It was sensible equipment for a soldier to wear, but that didn't make it look any less menacing. Luke could hear not the commentary pounding in his ears, but Han's voice, saying that the Alliance was rapidly turning into the Empire.
"Colonel Jason Solo, speaking earlier, said..."
Luke managed to look at Jaina, whose face was stricken. There was no other word for it.
"Jaina, let's take a walk."
There was no natural vegetation on Sentax. They found a spot in the shade of a hangar and sat down on a couple of crates.
"We can fence around this or we can blurt it out," said Luke. "I prefer blurting, personally."
"Saves time."
"I don't know what's happening to Jason."
"Neither do I, Uncle."
"Try a guess, then."
"I don't know him anymore."
"That's a scary thing for any twin to say."
"There's something dark about him now. He shuts me out. I can't trust him now."
Luke didn't want to hear it said aloud, but he knew he had to listen.
Mara sensed it too, but was satisfied that it was the opposing passions of a messy love affair that were creating the darkness. Luke thought of the images he had seen in recent days and knew that the darkness was separate from any problems Jason had in his love life. It was graphic enough to be captured on Holocam. "I want my son to stay away from him." Luke thought of Lumaya and his dreams of the hooded figure, which was surely her. But those signs of impending disaster were new. Jason had opened the rift with Jaina by tricking her into attacking the Chiss several years earlier. Jedi were used to seeing what ordinary people couldn't. Being deceived, something regular folk learned to live with from an early age, was especially threatening for them. "But you're not fooling me, Jason. You're turning to the dark side."
"Bravo Company, 967 Commando, Vehicle Checkpoint, Galactic City, Lower Levels, 2330 hours.
"We left the best till last," said Corporal LeCouf. Ben was confident in his lightsaber skills, but the lower levels of Galactic City made him envy the soldier's armor. It was the first time he'd been to the city's grim heart, and it wasn't like the Senate sectors at all. One soldier from Bravo Company set a vehicle barrier across the end of the road, a chain of small, spherical droids whose armament and stinger cords could stop a vessel attempting to pass anywhere up to 30 meters away. There was another one at the far end of the street. The only level below this one was made up of utility tunnels. Standing well behind the barriers were small knots of people, human and other species, who looked as if they might cut Ben's throat just out of curiosity.
"This is horrible," he said. "Beats doing this in broad daylight, with HNE breathing down our necks," said LeCouf. "We can just go in and clear this place out. This isn't a Corellian neighborhood."
"Not all the threats are Corellian." LeCouf turned at the sound of jogging boots, and Ben followed his gaze to see Captain Shivu approaching.
"Okay, listen up," said Shivu. He gathered two squads around him, pulling in Ben and LeCouf too. "Best intelligence is that Customs and Immigration got a tip-off about three Corellian agents and a bounty hunter they made contact with, and CSF tracked them down here."
The location was an apartment block with some boarded-up windows that sat between a sleazy bar and a brightly lit building whose business Ben wasn't sure about, except that the staff all seemed to be women.
"That's who we've come for. Names are Khotan, Abadener, Bulf, and Haber."
Shivu handed Ben a datapad with pictures on it. The squads were receiving the images via the HUDs in their helmets.
"They know we're here," Ben said.
"Not much they can do about it then, except come out when we ask nicely," said LeCouf.
Shivu tapped the charge indicator on his blaster rifle.
"Double-check them against your feature recog software, because they're going to be seriously armed, and you might need to put them out of business permanently. Colonel Solo's covering the rear exit with two squads if things don't go to plan."
It wasn't a raid so much as a siege. Ben had learned an awful lot about storming buildings in a very short time.
"Okay, let's start this like good guys," Shivu said.
He turned toward the front of the apartment block, and there was an audible click from his voice projection unit. He was about to use the loudhailer setting. Ben braced for painfully loud noise.
"This is the security forces."
Shivu's voice vibrated off the buildings, slow and carefully enunciated.
"Khotan, Abadener, Bulf, Haber, surrender your weapons. Come out of the building and keep your arms above your heads. You can come out now, or we will enter and detain you."
A bolt of blaster fire spat from a window, and the squad returned fire as if by reflex.
"We tried," said Shivu. "Warut, put a flashbang through the window on my mark, will you?"
"Sir,"
said the sergeant, and slipped a charge into the feet of his grenade launcher. The raid was surprisingly quiet. Ben could see the occasional flare of light through windows as blasters discharged, and heard the accompanying faint bada-bada-bada-bada of rounds. It was as if the whole neighborhood was holding its breath, waiting for the fighting to be over. Then Warut reacted as if someone unseen had tapped him on the shoulder. He aimed his grenade launcher, and there was a whoosh of gas as the flashbang shot into the building. Ben caught the fallout of the deafening sound and blinding light even from 20 meters away, and his ears took a few seconds to hear the shouts and hammering sound of blaster bolts as soldiers stormed the apartment. Silence fell. Shivu cocked his head as if listening, and the faint wail of a child somewhere inside made Ben's hair stand on end.
"Okay,
said Shivu. Two targets down, two unaccounted for. Ben, with me. Let's work our way down from the top. Every apartment that opened its doors voluntarily to them was full of suspicious, hostile faces that were clearly no strangers to visits from the authorities. But Ben sensed no purpose or immediate danger. He kept close to Shivu, and when they emerged on the next floor, Jason was already crouched outside one apartment talking earnestly to a couple of 967 men. He beckoned Ben to him. What do you sense in there, Ben? Ben closed his eyes and imagined the rooms beyond the double doors. He'd seen the interiors of enough apartments in the block now to picture the layout within. When he concentrated, he felt the prickling in his throat that indicated an immediate threat, and his mind was drawn to one room where a man and a woman had some grim purpose. I don't like the feeling of that either, said Jason. I think it's our two missing targets. Jason held up his left hand and lowered it along the line where the two doors joined, not touching them. He was a clear meter away. The doors shot apart, slamming back into the housing on either side, and Jason's lightsaber seemed to have a life of its own as he deflected red blaster bolts that flared from inside the apartment. Two people inside, yes, a man and a woman, he'd been right, aimed at Jason. But the blasters flew from their hands as if snatched by an unseen hand. The woman, about as old as Ben's mother, dark hair scraped back from her face and a tattoo across one eye, scrambled to reach for something, probably another blaster. But Jason slammed her flat against the wall with the force and pinned her there. The man lay slumped against a chair, groaning. The squad poured in, and the two prisoners were cuffed and dragged out. Shivu eased off his helmet and stood wiping his forehead on the back of his glove.
You're going to have to give us a list of your functions, sir, he said with a faint smile. Can't quite keep up with your box of tricks.
Neither can I sometimes, said Jason. He turned to Ben. You okay?
Fine, said Ben.
You were going to tell me something a few days ago, remember?
About what?
Something about reporting someone.
Ah, Barrett.
Barrett hadn't actually shot anyone, but he tried pretty hard. Was it right to turn him in? He might have already been interned or deported, but he might not. And whatever sympathy Ben might have felt for him, he might try again.
You're in this now. You know what the stakes are. You're not here to be liked, and Jason needs you. He needs you to be loyal. The family is called Sai,
said Ben.
They run an engineering company.
Jason Solo's apartment, Rotunda Zone.
The one thing you could count on with Corellians was that if you knocked them down, they got up again and again and again. Jason had been too preoccupied with the anti-terror operations to devote time to sensing what Thrak and Sal Solo might be doing from a strategic point of view. Fleet intelligence seemed to have that under control. But he knew that Centerpoint would remain an issue as long as it hadn't been totally destroyed. And this morning, his uncle didn't disappoint him. Jason had joined the billions of Coruscanti whose morning now began by switching on the HNE news, even before the first cup of caff, to check how close to war they were getting. HNE was running an interview from Corellian Hollow News with Sal Solo, in which he announced work was about to start on restoring Centerpoint Station to operational status. Jason forgot about caff and breakfast, left Ben to sleep off the previous night's operation, and went straight to the Senate. Nyathol, always an early riser, had beaten him to it. He found her in Omis's offices, and he knew the Admiral and he had one thing in mind. Omis was watching the holoscreen he now had running permanently in his private office.
Diplomacy by Hollow News, he said irritably.
Nyathol nodded at Jason to sit beside her, a little psychological display of unity in front of their reluctant chief.
Did you think Sal Solo would pick up the comlink and ask if it was okay to start work on Centerpoint again?
Jason glanced discreetly at her. Her expressions were becoming as easy to read as her emotions. She was satisfied. I don't think we have any choice, he said. We can't ignore this.
I hate that phrase.
Omis turned down the audio volume.
Because it's usually true these days. It's going to take two fleets to isolate Corellia, said Nyathol. I am asking you for authority to pull the 3rd and 5th fleets back from exercises on the Outer Rim.
Omis wore an expression of weary resignation, but the edge in his voice said different.
I need authority from the Senate first.
Getting 2 fleets into position to begin a blockade takes time. You start all the Senate procedures, and we'll get the logistics in hand. Then we'll be ready to deploy as soon as the authority is given.
We?
Omis asked pointedly, looking at Jason.
The Defense Force,
Nyathol said stiffly.
Don't jump the gun, said Omis. I have to table this as an emergency motion. We have to carry the rest of the Alliance with us.
Jason followed the Admiral out into the corridor and into her offices at the far end of the floor. They didn't speak until the doors were closed behind them and she had pressed the key set in her desk.
Just to be certain, she said, this is the secure link that doesn't go via fleet comms, then.
You're recalling those 2 fleets, aren't you?
I don't have to ask the Senate's authority to move assets already committed to exercises.
So you just bring them back home for exercises? Here?
Almost.
She hit a few more keys.
No point letting the enemy prepare for a blockade, or it just prolongs the thing. I've drawn up plans for the blockade.
Total exclusion zone?
No. 2 exclusion zones. One to stop Corellia resupplying Center Point. If we rely purely on isolating Corellia, then the embargo will take years to bite. If they can't get material up to Center Point, then that does the job a lot faster.
Jason thought about the mass of industrial orbiters strung around the planet. That means creating 2 sterile zones.
That's why I need both fleets. I'm going to share the plan with the fleet commanders. Then they stand off a couple of hours' jump from Corellia, and they're ready to deploy the moment the Senate gives the word.
I would like to play a role in the blockade, Jason said. Nyathol projected a holo chart of the Corellian system onto the wall and stood back to study it.
You're a fighter pilot, aren't you? Like your sister.
I'd like a command.
A ship?
A squadron. I'm confusing you, aren't I?
I thought you already had quite a substantial command as head of the Galactic Alliance Guard.
I'd like to show that I'm prepared to fight in the front line, Jason said.
I think everyone knows that from your combat record.
That wasn't against my father's homeworld.
Ah, the ultimate loyalty test, said Nyathol.
If you like.
Very well. You can have temporary group command. That'll include the squadron your sister commands. Unusual to have one colonel under another, but it's not unknown. If that doesn't demonstrate that the Solo family puts nation before family, I don't know what will.
Thank you, Admiral.
Slave 1, en route to Corellia.
What's up with you?
Fett asked. Myrta kept chewing her lip. It was a very discreet habit, but Fett was alert to small detail. Hunters had to be. Where are we heading?
Corellia.
You said Coruscant.
No, you said Coruscant.
Fett switched the navigation display to a 3D holochart so that she could see it shimmering above the console in front of the view screen.
I've got business in Corellia first.
She fell silent. And seeing as she hadn't said a great deal on the journey anyway, he wasn't shocked. But something had agitated her. Maybe it was the messages she kept sending to Coruscant. Aelin wasn't answering. I've lost contact with my customer, Myrta said at last.
She might not want to pay up. Is it just the necklace, or did you have information for her?
Information, too.
You weren't stupid enough to give her the data over the comlink, were you?
No.
And she'll pay up.
He opened his own comlink. It didn't matter if Myrta heard this.
Baveen, I have a job I'd like to discuss with you.
It took a while for Baveen to answer.
Mandalore!
Baveen, Threk and Sal Solo wants us to fight for him, defending Centerpoint Station.
Yes, it's all over the news. He was on HNE this morning about rebuilding it yet again. War's about to kick off, Solo's son is head of the Alliance's secret police, and the Corellians are really a-deadling about it.
Assemble as many commandos as you can. Meet me on Drawl in 2 days at Halen's Bar.
It closed down 5 years ago. Try this area. Same street.
I'm out of touch. Too much time on Terrace. Okay. Make it this area.
High Council Chamber, Jedi Temple, Coruscant.
Luke knew events had reached the point where he could do nothing to pull the Alliance back from confrontation with Corellia. There was only damage limitation. A blockade was the least destructive option. The Jedi Council sat in a grim circle, as it must have done many times in the face of war over the millennia, and seemed to look to him for an answer. Corrin Horn, Corellian, stubborn, unperturbed, was there. At least Jason had the decency not to round up a senior Jedi Master in his purges.
"A blockade is simply going to rally other worlds to Corellia's cause," said Horn.
"Attacking Corellia directly isn't going to achieve anything different," Luke said. "And letting Corellia have its way is going to encourage every other government to follow suit."
"Then the only question is to ask what the role of the Jedi Council is going to be in this."
"Same as it's always been," said Kyle Katarn, "looking for a peaceful solution, but ready to fight for the Alliance if called upon."
Silgall interrupted.
"With respect, Master Skywalker, there is a question we all appear to be unwilling to mention."
"Which is?"
"The actions of Jason Solo."
"If you want to raise that, let's be specific." Luke fought down a reflex to turn to Mara and say, "See, they noticed it too."
"May I ask if you have misgivings about a Jedi being seen to act against civilians like this?"
Silgall squirmed visibly, but Luke admired her courage for confronting him when nobody else seemed willing to point out that his nephew was behaving badly by Jedi standards. By any standards.
"With your own son accompanying him."
"I'm deeply troubled by it." There was a collective intake of breath.
"Is that it?" said Kip Duren.
"I have no control over Jason. He exists outside the Jedi Order, and he isn't Ben's master, and Ben is not his apprentice."
"Let's put this another way," said Katarn. "It's an embarrassment for the Jedi Order to see the son and nephew of the Grand Master kicking down doors with the boys in black."
"But you accept that the Galactic Alliance Guard is acting legally?"
"Unpalatably, but legally, yes."
Katarn and Silgall had now formed up into a definite but respectful attack, as if they were relieved that they weren't imagining it all.
"It's the involvement of Jedi in it that we're most uncomfortable with."
"I am too," Luke said at last. "I'll be asking Ben to withdraw from operations with the guard."
"He's 13, said Duren. "You should be telling him."
Mara said nothing, but Luke could feel her boiling inside.
"Jason's clearly popular with the public," Duren added carefully. "And more than one of us in this chamber has gone to some extremes and come back okay. So maybe we should be making an effort to help him identify more with the Order."
"Meaning?" said Luke.
"It's time he became a master. We all know what he can do."
"Let me think about that," said Luke. The meeting broke up shortly afterward. Mara said nothing to Luke until they were well out of earshot, sitting in their speeder on the way back to the apartment.
"I want Ben away from Jason," Luke said at last.
"Honey, we've discussed that."
"I'm sorry it came up in the meeting, but I can't turn a blind eye to it any longer. It stops now. No 13-year-old should be out on raids with Jason's secret police. He's having a bad affair."
"Bad affair?
He's interning Corellians."
"When did you last talk to Ben?"
"When he came back after being gassed."
"Well, I speak to him most days, and he's a changed kid. He's happy, he's respectful, he's calm. He's grown up, Luke. Jason did that."
And this was why they had come to this point. Because there was nobody else who could handle Ben like Jason could. Luke was no farther forward, but he could ask Jason not to take him on raids.
"There's something else you need to know, honey," said Luke, "and it's not good.
It can't be worse than this. It could be.
It was time. Luke couldn't hold it back any longer. He was grateful for the auto-navigating skylanes of Coruscant, because he doubted if he could have flown straight unaided right then. Lumaya's back. I don't know where or how, but she's back.
Alliance Fleet Flagship Ocean, Corellian System, 0459 hours, Coruscant time.
Admiral Cha Nyathol checked her personal chrono and then looked up at the bridge bulkhead to check the ship's readout.
Any signals?
Jason hadn't seen Flag Lieutenant Vio's eyes leave the comm console for an hour. If Corellia had backed down, he'd have known.
No, ma'am, said Vio.
I'll take that silence as a get lost, then, she said. Flag, make this to all ships. Interdiction measures are now in force. Corellia is under blockade.
The ships had taken up stations in two distinct zones, one encircling Corellia at 200,000 kilometers, and the other between the surface of the planet and the orbiting factory complexes and shipyards where Corellia's industrial heart lay. Corellia was cut off now from outside traffic, and more significantly, from its own factories and power stations. Jason watched the deployment of the ships, from destroyers to fast patrol craft, on the tactical holo display that mirrored the larger chart in Ops. Nearly 300 small craft now patrolled the inner cordon, ready to stop traffic movement from Corellia's surface to the industrial orbiters. Beyond the orbital ring, destroyers and cruisers waited for the inevitable. Ansta has contact at 500,000 clicks, ma'am, the comm officer announced. Nyathol didn't move a muscle.
So Admiral Cheeb gets first bite.
Jason could feel Jaina's anxiety many decks below in the hangar. He knew she couldn't feel his because he had withdrawn from the Force, cloaking himself against detection. It was time to make his impressions on the thousands of officers and ratings in the Interdiction Task Force. Permission to put Rogue Squadron on Alert 5, ma'am.
Carry out, Colonel Solo.
Reputations spread like wildfire in ships. Jason knew what he wanted his to be. The officer who would never shirk his responsibility, and who would never ask anyone to do what he wouldn't do himself. It made you friends. Jason knew he would need every one of them in the months to come.
High security cell block, Galactic Alliance Guard Headquarters, Coruscant.
Ben checked his comlink and saw that he now had five calls waiting from his father. When he was with Jason, he felt shielded from the weight of Luke's presence. But now, he felt very alone and hunted. He was pretty sure his father could sense where he was. He hated that. He felt he had no privacy. But so far, the interference was purely calls, even though Luke must have known that Jason had joined the blockade. Ben concentrated on the matter in hand, which was learning from Captain Shivu. Shivu was head-to-head with another captain, Gurdon, having one of those whispered, angry fights that adults had.
We have rules, said Shivu, and until the Senate tells me those rules have changed, I live by them.
Yes, let's hear you taking that fine moral stance when someone gets assassinated and we might have stopped it.
Prisoners get 5 hours break from questioning in 24. You want to do it different? Not on my watch.
The man and woman they had detained in the apartment block were in separate holding cells. The man was a small-time Corellian agent, possibly called Buroy, possibly not, who had been identified from the NRI's database. The woman was probably Kifar, judging by her facial tattoo, and her name was Aelin Haber. Shivu had taken a comlink from her, and it had stored three messages since she'd been captured, all from someone called Mir Tagev. Shivu got his way. Gurdon stalked off.
You don't have to stay, said Shivu, tapping the security code into the cell's lock.
Ben was afraid that if he went back to the apartment, his father would find him and confront him, and he wouldn't have the will to stand up to him. Either that, or they'd fight, and Ben hated having fights.
I might be able to help.
The door slid open. Shivu gave him a dubious look.
This is just a regular interrogation. the way we did in CSF. If you can mind influence, great. If not, don't worry.
You know we do that?
I don't think it's classified information somehow.
Aylin Haber was sitting at a table, hands on the surface in front of her. She was handcuffed, and her face still bore the marks of the scuffle when she was arrested. The tattoo that surrounded her left eye was unnerving, and she was the hardest-looking woman Ben had ever seen. Wiry and unsmiling, with thin, sinewy forearms that made her look as if she spent her time strangling people.
"Okay, ma'am," said Shivu, sitting down opposite her. "You keep some unsavory company."
"It's not illegal to be a bounty hunter."
"Depends on what you're hunting."
"Not illegal to be in the same apartment block as Corellians either, but I see you're working on that."
"Look, ma'am, this is how we do things."
Shivu was quiet and polite.
"You give me a good reason why you're holed up with a Corellian agent and carrying some serious hardware, and why you chose to shoot it out with the 967, and I'll let you leave. Otherwise, I tend to think you're a threat to security, and in that case, you stay here until you rot, if you're lucky."
Haber slid back in her seat, all ice, and then glanced at Ben.
"What's the kid here for?"
"Training."
"You start your thugs young on Coruscant."
Shivu laid Haber's comlink and datapad on the table in front of her. Ben watched, feeling how stressed she was. There was something unfocused about her, as if her hostility and anxiety were directed at something that wasn't in the room.
"You like spacecraft for some reason?"
Haber shrugged.
"Beats walking."
"You got a lot of images of them on your datapad."
Shivu switched on the pad and showed them to her.
"Who did you have under surveillance?"
Haber just stared back at him. Ben craned his neck to get a look at the images on the pad, but it was all just a blur from this angle. Shivu went on, still with that tone of bored patience.
"Just cut the poodoo and tell me why you're here. If it's just some lowlife you've been sent to vape, I'm too busy to worry about that."
"Don't I get a lawyer?"
"Under the emergency powers I've been granted, no. You get zip."
"You'll be banging my head on the table pretty soon, then."
"You want me to call your friend?"
"I don't have any."
"The one who keeps contacting you."
"Who?"
"Mirtagev," said Shivu.
Haber's face was completely unmoved, but Ben felt a little flare of strong emotion. Fear, dismay, yearning, well up and surround her like an energy field. Shivu reacted to it too. Ben wondered how non-force users could sense things that well hidden.
"She was recovering some jewelry from me."
And that sounded like the truth.
"My mother's necklace."
"Looks like she's got it."
Haber said nothing and remained apparently relaxed in the Durasteel seat, even though the muscles in her jaw had started to twitch. Shivu got up and beckoned Ben to follow him outside. The captain closed the doors.
"Go and get Gurdon for me. I want to check out this Mirtagev again. If she's on her way here, I'd like to welcome her to the capital personally. Especially if she's armed like Madame in there." "Are you happy leaving her with Gurdon?"
Shivu frowned slightly.
"That's a very grown-up question." "He feels pretty nasty." "That's a force judgment, is it?"
"Yes."
"It's spot on. He's a former New Republic intelligence officer. He's used to different rules than the ones we had to follow as police. But he wouldn't dare cross me on this."
"Okay."
Shivu was very much in command, even if the two men had the same rank.
"Right away."
Shivu went back into the interrogation room, and Ben went in search of Captain Gurdon, trying to walk briskly and not break into a run. He found the man in the barracks gymnasium. The 967, being newly formed, didn't have a proper headquarters yet, and had taken over a fleet reserve training center. Gurdon, who never looked at ease in his black uniform, stood talking to a couple of sergeants. Somehow it took Ben a few seconds to see the ranks of people behind him, sitting cross-legged on the floor with their hands on top of their heads, fingers meshed. Some of them looked like the kind of people Ben would avoid at all costs, and some looked pretty ordinary. Most were male.
"Latest haul," said the sergeant. "Nice tip-off, kid."
Ben still scanned the gymnasium, silent except for the heavy sense of people breathing nervously, in the way of someone who felt he ought to recognize one of the prisoners. He did. His gaze jerked to a halt on a blonde boy a few years older than he was. Barrett Saeed sat in the ranks of the Corellians arrested during the night,
staring at Ben with an expression of utter loathing.
Yeah, great tip,
said Gurdon, distracted.
What did you want me for?
Ben knew at that moment that he would never be a child again. He wished more than anything that he could.
Zarya's Bar, Drawl, Corellian System.
Mandalore,
said a voice Fett didn't recognize.
Gal-galar.
The soldier took off his Mandalorian helmet and gave Fett a stiffly formal nod. A baby's handprint in charcoal paint adorned the helmet of his gray-blue armor, a curious foil for the Verpine rifle slung over his left shoulder.
This is Ram,
said Bavine.
Ram Zeramar. He's our star sniper for those delicate jobs.
Zeramar nodded politely. Fett wanted to ask about the handprint, but didn't. Myrta gave Fett one of her subtly admonishing looks. He was attuned to them now. And he says he wants to buy you a drink, she said.
Later.
Fett returned Zeramar's nod.
Let's talk first.
There was nothing like half a dozen fully armored Mandalorian warriors to guarantee you a table to yourself in a crowded bar. Bavine introduced them. Zeramar, Breek, Orad, Bavut, and Talgal, the only woman, and one who looked as if she ate Yuuzhan Vong for appetizers. Apart from Bavine, none had fought with him against the Vong, and he didn't know them. He studied their faces while they looked suspiciously at Myrta.
Bounty hunter,
said Fett.
Myrta gave, Mandalorian father.
They thawed instantly.
So, how do you feel about defending Centerpoint Station?
Fett asked. There was a disinterested silence. Orad, buzz-cut blonde hair, broken nose, a brush of gold beard on the point of his chin, folded his arms on the table and made a fresh scrape in the polished surface.
What do you think?
I think Sal Solo is a self-serving, sadistic liar, but then most of my customers are. He's also going to lose, and losers can't pay. But I'll hear him out. How do you feel about it?
Unenthusiastic, said Vavut.
Another stranger. He had long black woolly braids bound with gold rings, and his left cheek was scored by an impressive scar.
Maybe we wait and see before we commit ourselves.
If you really thought it was worth it, you'd get the whole 100 behind you, Mandalore,
said Bavine.
I'm heading for Corellia now,
said Fett.
You'll have to beat the blockade, then.
I will. You still flying, Gladiators?
We are.
Form up and follow Slave One, then. Let's see if the Alliance remembers that we fought against the Vong for them.
Corellian Blockade, Inner Exclusion Zone.
Rogue Squadron maintained formation behind Jason's XJ-7 as the fighters patrolled the exclusion zone around Corellia. It took 5 standard hours to circle the planet at maximum speed. The squadron was flying a cube pattern around a cluster of orbital units that made up a shipyard. Probably a less glamorous target than Centerpoint, but a significant one nonetheless. And somewhere aft of his port wing, mistrustful and angry, was Jaina. Maybe it was his instant elevation to Colonel. She'd worked for her rank. He could feel her, a bright fire of resentment and anger. Zack was on his starboard side. For a few moments, the squadron touched minds in a battle meld, but it didn't feel as united as it once had.
I've lost you, Jaina. In the end, I might lose everyone's love. Maybe even Tenel Ka. But it has to be done.
Jason shook himself out of regret, and the squadron broke into 6 paired patrols, fanning out into the orbits of the industrial space stations and shipyards around Corellia. Jason switched to the main OPSCOM link to hear the voice traffic between other squadrons' pilots and forward air control.
On our maintenance transport inbound for Centerpoint, moving to intercept. Copy that. Visual on the transport, confirmed, unarmed. Intercepting now, range 5 kilometers.
He's holding course. Let's see who blinks first.
He's slowing.
And now you've got company. Corellian fighter range 10 kilometers, moving to transport's position, fast.
Got him on scanner. Now visual too.
It was the first test of wills.
Back off, pal.
Whoa, that was close.
He's locked onto me. Cleared to engage.
He's breaking off. Transport is altering course.
Zek cut into Jason's comlink circuit. It seemed Jason wasn't the only one listening to the chatter.
Shouldn't we be there?
Centerpoint isn't the only game in town. Patience, Zek. Centerpoint might have been the political focus, but Jason knew the leverage would be in the factories and power stations orbiting Corellia. There was a total of 1 million workers in those orbiters. People with families down on the surface who cared about them.
Contact, bearing 25 by 40 from Datum.
Zek's XJ-7 blipped on Jason's onboard scanner as it peeled off to investigate. He watched as Zek pinged the vessel with his sensors. The shared display outlined a big, ungainly ship that appeared to be one large tank.
Okay. Profile looks like a replenishment ship. Water tanker and food. Panic over.
Turn it back, then.
What?
Orders are to turn back all vessels. Zek's comlink made a slight pop as if he'd switched it off for a moment.
But it's just water and catering. It's not industrial or military.
Zek didn't get it sometimes. Jason wondered why he saw angles that other Jedi didn't. Those orbiters can only recycle and condense so much water a day. The shortfall has to be topped up.
You think that's worth doing?
Rule of three.
What?
3 minutes without air, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food. That's how long a humanoid can last, and they're mostly Corellians on those orbiters. The first thing every commander should learn about a siege. There are 10,000 workers in that orbital yard alone, and they're not going home just yet, and they're not going to be resupplied. That makes people sweat. Zek's comlink popped again. Maybe he was silencing the audio to swear for a moment.
Who's this shapeshifter, and what has he done with Jason?
He said sourly. Just turn back the Bowser, Zek. I'm not running a popularity contest.
Very good, sir.
Zek's tone said otherwise, but Jason watched him roll his XJ-7 into a dive and head straight for the water. Jaina's voice was almost a whisper in Jason's comlink.
Is this policy?
Turn back all vessels means turn back all vessels. Do you have a problem with that?
Just a humanitarian one.
It'll bring Corellia to the negotiation table a lot faster without shots being fired.
Well, you're in command, said Jaina, all acid. Colonel Solo.
Jason wondered if any other squadron was quite as casual in its attitude to orders as Rogue. He doubted it.